Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Academy Award winner, Sean Connery.
For more than 100 years, the world has been fascinated by the movies. They are more than just an entertainment. They are the force that binds us together, the common link that touches the humanity of all of us. And that's why we love to watch the movies. And so tonight, our Academy invites the world to celebrate the magic of going to the movies. Enjoy!
Well, the force that ties us all together, the common link that brings us together is humanity. What is it about a story that captures all of us? What is it about Hollywood that makes a billion people watch the Academy Awards? Why do we love music? Why is country music the number one genre in our nation today? I think it's because country music tells a story. There's a reason that we're so drawn to Danielle Steele, to novels, and to movies. Because in every great story, there's something there that deeply borrows from another story that is innately placed in us. That if you understand this story, you understand everything that you were designed to be. Here's one that I read a number of years ago that reminds me that when I see certain things that are greater than me, that maybe there is a story that God is trying to reveal to us through all of our stories that He wants to anchor us in. It's a story that a guy told who has a child that is learning disabled, is the way we say it in today's day and time. And he stood up to speak at a school that he was doing a fundraiser for. And he started by saying this. He said, "Where is the perfection in my son, Shia? Everything God does is done with perfection, but my child doesn't understand things as other children do. My child cannot remember facts and figures as other children do. Where is God's perfection?" The audience was shocked by the question, the writer put. They were pained by the father's anguish, instilled by the piercing query. "I believe," the father answered, "that when God brings a child like this," talking about his son, "into the world, that we see perfection not in the child, but in the way that we respond to the child." And then he told this story. One afternoon, Shai and I were walking past the park where some boys were playing baseball. And Shia asked me, he said, "Dad, do you think they'll let me play?" I knew that my son was not at all athletic, as most boys were, and that they would not want him on their team. But I also understood that if my son was allowed to play, it would give him a sense of belonging. And so I approached one of the boys in the field and asked if my son could play. The boy that I asked looked around for guidance from his teammates, and getting none, he took matters into his own hands and said, "We're losing by 6 runs and the game is in the 8th inning. I guess he can be on our team and we'll try to put him up to bat sometime in the 9th inning. So I was ecstatic. My son smiled broadly and they put a glove on him and put him in short center field to play. In the bottom of the 8th inning, the team that my son was on scored a few runs but was still behind by 3. In the bottom of the 9th inning, Shia's team scored again. And now with 2 outs and the bases loaded with a potential winning run on base, my son was scheduled to be up. I thought to myself, is this team going to actually let my son bat at this juncture and give away any chance they have to win the game? And to my surprise, they gave my son a bat. Everyone knew it was all but impossible because my son didn't even know how to hold the bat properly, let alone hit with it. However, as he stepped up to the plate, the pitcher moved a little bit closer. He lobbed the ball softly so at least my son would have a chance to make contact. The first pitch came in and Shia swung clumsily. He completely missed. And one of his teammates then came out and came up next to him. And together they held the bat. And they faced the pitcher waiting for the next pitch. The pitcher again took a few steps closer now and tossed the ball one more time. As the pitch came in, Shia and his teammate now swung the bat. And together they hit a slow grounder right to the pitcher. The pitcher picked up the soft grounder and could easily have thrown the ball to the first baseman, thus ending the game. But instead, he took the ball and he threw it on a high arc all the way to right field. far beyond the reach of the first baseman, anybody else that might get it. Everybody started yelling, Shia, run to first, run to first. Never in his life had Shia run to first. He scampered down the line, his eyes wide open and startled. By the time he reached first base, the right fielder had the ball. He could have thrown the ball to second base, who would have tagged Shia out because he was still running. But the right fielder understood the pitcher's intention, so he threw the ball high and over the shortstop's head. And everyone yelled, run to second, Shia, run to second. And Shia ran towards second base as the runners ahead of him deliriously circled the bases towards home. As Shia reached second base, the opposing shortstop now ran to him, turned him in the direction of third base, and shouted, run to third. As my son rounded third, the boys from both teams ran behind him now screaming, Shia, run home. And Shia ran home. He stepped on home plate. And then all 18 boys that were out there playing before I walked up lifted my son up on his shoulders and made him the hero as he had just hit a grand slam and won the game for his team. That day, said the father then softly, the guy wrote, as he had tears rolling down his face, he said, that day I saw why my God had made my son, so that others could show God's perfection in the way that he loved him. You see, there's something about that story when you and I hear it, and my heart goes out to those 18 kids that did that. I just want to go grab them all. When I hug them, I go, there's something so divine about what you just did. Something so loving, something so right, something so deeply embedded in my heart that when I see it, I cannot resist it. I am completely drawn to it. This hope that we matter, not because we can hit a grand slam and be the hero, but this hope that we matter just because we are worthy of being loved, and that at times something would come around us and embrace us and allow us to be what we all long to be, which is completely accepted, woven in intimacy to greatness, and to experience the glory that we were designed to experience. There's something divine about what those boys did that day that resonates deeply with a story that is in my soul. And what we're going to talk about these next 9 weeks is a story that is going to resonate deeply with your soul. We've put together a little series that we're going to spend the next 9 weeks on. It's called Why. And a little card that we use to let you know what we're going to talk about, we just said this. We all love a great story. One filled with rescue, romance, and unrelenting love. One filled with courage, heroism, and ultimate triumph. Something that when we hear it resonates with something deep inside us. The reason why is found in one story. A story that is so embedded in our beings that even a shadow of it is irresistible to us. It's a story that makes the most audacious claim in history and offers to answer all our questions. If you've never thought of God as a hero, if you've never imagined him as the ultimate rescuer of a lover taken captive, if you don't understand how our history is leading to his triumph, then you're in the right place for the next 9 weeks. We're going to do something that is very uncomfortable to those of us that are in the West. We're going to teach truth in a story. If you went back 2,000 years ago, you'll find that there was a time that Jesus left propositional idea, truth that men were called to respond to start to present truth in the context of a story in order to reveal more truth to those that wanted it and to give those that really were putting off his propositional claims in a way that wouldn't incur even more judgment on themselves. We're going to talk, and specifically today, we're going to frame to you the story, and then we're going to unfold the history that is God's story, make a case for him being the one author that you want to write into your life. And I should say it this way, the one author that if you don't let him oversee the writing that is your life, you will find yourself in constant tension with the reality of the world that you live in. There is one story that answers every question that we have. Questions that we have about why we're here. Why is there so much pain? Why do I feel so empty? Why do I exist? What is my purpose? Where is joy? Why does hope escape me? Why all the horror in a movie like The Passion of Christ? What was the reason behind that? Why the brutality? Why the hate? Why the inconsistency, betrayal, ignorance? Why the courage, endurance, love, forgiveness, perseverance? What is the reason for this world that we're living in? The Bible provides the answer to that. The Bible is a book that has a very arrogant title. It is called La Biblia, the book. It is the book that tells the story. And any other resource that we go to frame the reality that we find ourselves living in is in the fiction category. And there is only one book that is a non-fictional account that explains everything that philosophers for ages have been trying to get their arms around. Now, men have rejected the story of God. They don't believe that history is His story. And so they've got to come up with other stories, and they've invented many. They become their own author. Self-authorship is another word for rebellion. Trading the invisible, pure image of God for a lesser image of God that they can control and dictate, that they can create their own explanations. What we're talking about when we use the phrase story here is a phrase that is commonly used called a worldview, a conceptual filing cabinet, a reality, a pair of lenses that you see the world through that frames what is right, what is wrong, what is true, and what gives meaning to you. And what we're going to make a case for is that you will always find yourself wanting and hurting and longing until you understand the worldview that is given to you by the God that created it. And we're going to let you know that as you understand the story and the book from the author and creator, when you understand what He's up to and who He is, you'll start to have every question you've ever had answered. You may not like certain pages through the story. You may not even like the character that He's given you to play. But when you understand who He is as author and perfecter, as hero and redeemer, as lover and pursuer, you will find yourself engaged with God like you never thought you would before. Let me tell you what we have done in the church that has so uninspired us that we have lost the heart of the people. Now, in America today, there will be all kinds of folks that will show up in churches that will go through an act that supposedly causes them to have intercourse with God, but in large part, it's going to be heartless. And many of you might be here and have just sung some of the great songs we did about how His love is amazing. All the names of God we sang in that last song, He is holy, which really isn't an attribute of God. It's a defining adjective that describes everything about who God is. His love is holy, meaning there's no shadow in it, no shifting in it. His goodness is complete and pure. The word holy is an adjective which describes the fullness of anything. And we are inviting you, as we tell the story of God these next 9 weeks, to come to the light of nonfiction and place yourself squarely in His story and find the answers that you're looking for. Sean Connery, at the Oscars last week, told people that the reason that we are here and celebrate this is because we love a good story. We can't resist it. And I agree with the observation that others have made that what resonates with us in every story that is out there is the ultimate story, which is deeply embedded in all of our hearts. It's where God has placed the eternal story, where deep speaks to deep. God said that He has placed eternity in our hearts, and He's placed some other things. He has placed a love for life, a love for adventure, and a need to be loved, in that He made us in His image. Now, I talked to you about the fact that there's going to be lots of folks in places like this morning around this country and the world that are going to be there, but in a way that grieves God, because God doesn't just want you to accept Him as a propositional entity. He doesn't want you to understand Him as a God who exists in some reality that you just surrender to. He doesn't want you to honor Him with a statement of fact. You understand that? God is a person that is longing to have a relationship with you. And that's His story. And you're going to find that God is anything but boring and anything but distant and anything but sterile and, frankly, anything but safe. That God is alive, and in relationship with Him is the life that you've been looking for and the love that you've been seeking and the intimacy and wholeness that nothing else can provide. You see, here's what has happened to the gospel story over the last couple of thousand years. The gospel is just a word that we use to translate the idea of good news. Now, listen, this is what we have done to absolutely emasculate the good news that is the story that when you hear it will allow your heart to become wildly alive and fully loved. What else do you want? But what we've done is we've dumbed down the story to make it just a propositional statement. And it goes something like this. You are very, very bad. And God is very, very good. And at great cost to Himself, He has dealt with that. And because of His goodness, He has provided escape for you. And so now He wants you to be very, very good, polite and obedient in return for this sacrifice. And until He comes to get you and take you to the eternal church service in the sky. Right? Now, how many of y'all are looking forward to that? I mean, you think about it. You think about what we have put out there as the story of good news. Is that you're lousy, He's good. He paid a great price. You be good until He comes and takes you to a long worship service. How many of you guys go, I'm in for that, man? No, most of us have gotten away from Him so we can get away from the service. And when we find out that our heaven is one that never ends, we're like, okay, maybe not. And we've just given you a wafer of the truth. And we've taken it out of the context that this incredible facts that I've just laid out before you. We take away the meaning and the heart behind it. And God tells us, don't lose your heart, man. Guard your heart, He tells you. Guard your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the wellsprings of life. You make sure your heart stays alive and engaged. When you think of God, what do you think of? I mean, just invite you, close your eyes right now. You know, and sketch out God. What would you do? And in fact, I love the story of that little kid in Sunday school class. And he's sitting there doodling. His teacher says, what are you doing? He said, I'm drawing a picture of God. And she said, oh, nobody knows what God looks like. And he looked at him and said, they will in a minute. But most of us, when I ask you what's God look like, you think of somebody that's on a throne forever. And you're like, are you serious? Don't you get throne sores from that? Isn't there something more engaging and inspiring than a God that just sits there, scepter in hand, beard growing longer, Rip Van Winkle-ish, giving out orders and throwing out ideas from heaven? You need to know something, man. The God of this book is a God who is so alive, so wild, that you can't do anything but be attracted to Him. One of the things that I know Gibson went for in the movie, The Passion of Christ, is he was trying hard to jerk God out of this sterile idea that he saw in so many movies over the history of time as represented in a way that just left him with a pansy Jesus. There's a guy named Martin Bell that he wrote a little deal right here about who Jesus was as he thought about him as he read the Gospels. And he wrote it this way. He says, there he is in the temple again, causing trouble. Speaking very differently from other preachers, speaking with authority about sorrow, anxiety, sickness and death, penetrating the dark corners of human existence, shattering illusion. Make no mistake about it. This is a dangerous man. I got to tell you, man, Jesus was the most intimately attractive person that ever lived for two reasons. When you were around Jesus, something was going on. You were either stirring up more trouble than you can ever imagine. You were walking into the temple and flipping the holy of holy, you know, place in all of Jerusalem up on its ears and taking on the rabbis and telling them they don't know what they're talking about. And then healing people to prove that you had the authority to do it. And then going out and him laughing with you and loving you and serving you. And I'm like, man, what a riot to be with this God. We think about the God of the Scriptures. We think about what the Lord did, how He reveals Himself. He is a God of heavy drama. He's a God of great love, and I'm going to tell you that story. But you think about some of the stories that we all know from the time that we were kids. We think about how He took a group of people, 2 million of them, that were slaves, being oppressed by this wicked leader we know as Pharaoh. He takes some shepherd that for 40 years has been trying to herd sheep. He tells them to take his shepherd crook, a stick, and to go against the greatest power in all the world. He said, I want you to go free my people. Well, how am I going to do that? What do you got? He said, I got a stick and I stutter. He goes, perfect. Come on. And so they show up. And through this crazy guy and this stick, all of a sudden, God starts to move and act and brings about great evidence that He is the Lord. But look what God does. He finally has them being led out of Egypt. And then where do they go? In the wilderness, up against the sea, when Pharaoh realizes that he should be angry and not releasing them. And so he turns all the torrent of his legions against them, and they race with him, chariots closing in on the people, backed up against the sea, and then God shows up. You get the idea that this is a God that's into some drama, don't you? You get the idea a little bit later. He has three of his favorite sons that take on the name Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who believe that God is the author of the story, and so they won't bow to somebody else who claims that he's the author of the story. And he says, I'm going to throw you in my brick kiln. I'm going to put it in there and make it seven times hotter, and I'm going to bake you boys. And so those guys get backed right up to the furnace, get thrown in there, and then God shows up. Another friend of his living in that day and time, a guy by the name of Daniel, is going to bow to one God, the author of the one story. And yet God has him thrown in a lion's den. And then God shows up. This is a God who's into some drama, people. And he is not boring to be around. In fact, if you've ever thought of God as a God that is safe, you don't know the God of the Scriptures. And one of the reasons that maybe some of you guys have moved away from him is you don't like the way some of the pages in your life are being written. You don't like the character that he's designed for you. You don't like the form that he's given you to play out this part in. You don't like the horror in the story that you can see from this perspective that you're forced to endure. And you wonder if he's a good author. And you wonder if he can be trusted. And I love what C.S. Lewis did in his Chronicles of Narnia, when young Lucy is in this city that has been taken over by the Wicked Witch. And here's this great story that we all respond to. Why? Because it borrows heavily from the story that is deeply embedded in us. And Lewis knew that. And so he was using a story to say, let me tell you, you live in the realm of the Wicked Witch who turns her subjects into lawn art, freezes them, and it's an eternal winter. And yet word is that Aslan, the lion, the son of the ruler, is on the move. That in the midst of this horror, there is hope that is coming. And he's a lion. And when Lucy hears that the Redeemer is a lion, and when she even hears that she and her brothers and sisters are to play a part in the prophetic story that was to free these people up from the slavery that the Wicked Witch had put them in, she can't believe that she gets to play a part in this great story, even that it's scary. And she does it in relationship with her faith in Aslan, who's coming. And she asks Mr. and Mrs. Beaver and says, is Aslan safe? And they said, oh, my dear, no, he's a lion. He's anything but safe, but he's good. And folks, all I want to do with you this morning is I'm going to frame something for you. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to make a case right now that you are living in the context of a story. One of my favorite things to do is to watch people and try and figure out what is their story. And I want to tell you today that you live in the midst of a story, and I'm going to tell you that the author of it is good, and I'm going to beg you to consider living in it. Last night, my wife let me slip away for a couple hours just to sit and be still and think about what I was going to do today, because this message is not typical for me. I'm much more comfortable dealing in propositional reality as opposed to telling a story that engages your hearts. And in that, I do that too often. I fail you as a teacher, because I want you to know something. The gospel of believe and behave accordingly will leave you sterile, cold, and vulnerable to a false author who will woo you towards more excitement. The idea that you're a sinner, but you've been forgiven, now do good things until you go to heaven, leaves you wanting more, and rightly so. And I'm going to tell you something. You and I are both sinners, and we are desperately needing to be forgiven. And through Jesus Christ alone is the means for that forgiveness provided through His death, burial, and resurrection. But I want to tell you something. If you just see the movie out of the context of where that fits in the eternal story of a God who is desperate for you to know His outrageous love and courage and goodness, it will not grip your heart the way that He wants. Last night I sat there and I watched a number of different folks at a little Starbucks that I was at. I watched two Hispanic couples. I didn't know if they were married or a double date or what it was, but they were reading a newspaper, speaking a language I didn't know, laughing at times, silent at times, and I could see them even move towards tender moments. And I thought to myself, what is their story? Where are they from? How do they get in the same room as I did? Where will they work this week? How do they provide for their families? And I thought about how much they were like me. I thought about the kid that, you know, gave my overpriced cup of coffee and how a little bit later, I saw him on his break walk outside of that Starbucks and put a stick of tobacco in his mouth. And with a look of despair and loneliness and emptiness that a 19 or 20 year old should never have, I saw that kid burn his 15 minute break as he burned that tobacco in his mouth. And I just looked at him and I watched him through that glass and I go, what is his story? You know, what's up with that guy? How did he get to be so alone at such a young age? Where are his parents? Where are his friends? What's he want to be? You know, when you see somebody do something wild, when you see somebody do something nuts, when you see somebody, you know, when you hear a news story about somebody did something horrible, it makes you go, what is their story? Because you know that if you understand their story, that somehow that will allow you to frame the reality that you're having to live with what they did, right? Jeffrey Dahmer, what was his story that he did that? That lady that hit that guy that he went sticking through her windshield, that she pulled him into her garage and let him die there over a 3-day period. What was her story? What was the story of the guy that was hit? What was he thinking as he stuck in that windshield and his part of God's grand drama, that was his role? What is their story? And then every now and then you see a different story and you think about great stories. And I use Hollywood again. Someone's made the observation, the movie Gladiator, a guy who's a general who becomes a slave, who becomes a warrior, who dares to take on a corrupt, evil empire and against all odds redeem others from its evil grip. Where does that come from? How about the movie Titanic? You've got innocence, love, romance, tragedy, fall, despair, sacrifice. He gives her life that she might live. Where does that come from? And you hear these stories and your heart responds to them. I'll tell you where they come from. They borrow deeply from a story that resonates in your soul. We love fairy tales. Why? Because there's something in them that makes us go, yes, it's got to be there. We love the fact that there are heroes who have hearts of gold. That Snow White, that Cinderella, that Sleeping Beauty are more than ordinary wenches. That they're valuable. That there's something worth sacrificing great deeds for. That Princess Fiona is worth fighting the dragon, that she might be released from her bondage and set free. And we hope and we pray that maybe in the fairy tale that is our life, that somebody will see behind this loud, raucous, angry fur with claws that scares people away and see that behind the beast there's a prince. We love the fact that in the story of the frog, and we've got warts and people don't love us because we don't look like we should love. We want to believe that somebody can see through our webbed feet and our croaking and go, there's somebody there. If he can just be kissed right, can be set free. There's a prince in that frog. And we hope that it's true. And we hope that somebody would kiss us and love us and break the curse that causes us to not experience the intimacy and love that we want in the midst of a life that's full of adventure that totally resonates with our hearts. When you meet a God who's telling you this is his story, you go, man, can I be your friend? Can I accept the love from you that I look for in other people, sometimes in desperate, radical ways? But this is history. This is his story. He's making a claim that he is the author, that you are his subject, that he wants to know you and love you and let you experience what has been eternally present in who he is. Now, so much of this I have borrowed recently from a book that sat on my shelf for 6 or 7 years. And because I'm a male, I didn't read it simply because of its title. The title was Sacred Romance. And in my stupidity, I thought that as a guy, you know, you given me a book that was titled, you know, Blood, Guts, and Courage, you know, I'd have gone, all right, let's read it. That I didn't have a part of me that really needed to know that there's a God who has this sacred love for me and that has been wooing me and trying to deliver me with blood, guts, and courage from an eternal winner. And I picked this book up and a couple of guys have done a great job of telling the story in a way that I think if we serve you well, will engage your hearts in a way that will move you beyond the gospel of just dormancy. You know, get you out of this mindset of being the frozen chosen that propositionally believe that Jesus was him who knew no sin, who became sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Do you know that God doesn't want you to sign off on a fact? That God is desperate for you to live in relationship with Him as a person. And when you know who He is as a person and the fact of His redeeming love for you, your heart will be wild in its surrender. And you will not be able to stay silent about the fullness of life in relationship with Him. And you will understand every why and have a place to go for every hurt. But if you reject this story, you will refuse to live without one. And in your rebellion, you will become your own author and probably will set yourself in the middle of your own story. And what you'll do is you'll try and write your own story through some effort of attaining love or greatness or security that will give you enough hope to make this life that you're in, this story that is your days, worth living. And yet you live in fear because you know that you're just one rain-slicked highway away from that car coming across and hitting yours broadside and taking away from you the life and security and health and what you've worked for that gives you what you think your hard work should have given you in the story that you think makes life worth living. And so you live in fear, constantly wondering if this is the day that your inability to control the story is going to end. You know, I'm a number of months ago in the community that I live, you know, many of us remember that little girl. You know, her story came to an end. And I, as a parent of a child, I would think about how my heart towards the author would just go, what are you thinking to only write this child into 5 years of my story? The pain that that brings me is immense. And I can't really put it in a category. And I've got to know the full story in order to have any sense of getting through that moment. But I went to an assembly. And in that assembly, there were a group of people there. And they met for a long time. And they talked about how the traffic patterns need to change. A stoplight needs to be put up here. More crossing guards at this end. Parents need to do a better job of holding their kids' hands. And one author after another stood up and said, we've got to change the reality of our day-to-day story so these things don't happen. And finally, somebody turned to me and said, Todd, would you give us just an idea of what you think we ought to do? And in a room full of parents at that elementary school, I just stood up and I just said, you know what, you guys are doing exactly what is normal to do in a situation like this. When the story takes a turn that nobody wants it to take, we start to say, okay, man, listen, we've got to get our pen to the paper and we've got to build ourselves up some walls so this doesn't ever happen in our stories again. But you need to realize something. We live in the context of a larger story, which we are not the center of, which we do not author, which we do not control. And the reality of it is we live in a broken world. And no matter what you do, you are never safe. And if you convince your kids that if they just did something, that they would be safe from any pain or hurt or loneliness or disease or death even that come into their life, your kids are going to grow up neurotic, scared, and believing that you're a liar because you won't be able to deliver and they will never rest for fear that in that one resting moment, they will have left the door open for evil to come crashing in. This is a broken world I shared with them. And what we need to do is have hope in the context of the one who tells us that He understands our pain and our frustration with where we are in the story. But He calls us to trust Him because He is good, even in the midst of this kind of pain. Now, let me just share with you that there is, as one man has written, we are in, if you will, a contest for people's hearts. And God has told us to be people who bring good news to others. And we are in a tournament of narratives. And everybody here has got a story, a worldview through which they see reality. There's a reason that on September 11, 2001, much of the world stood in horror, while other parts of the world danced in great joy. Because the story was different in two different places. Osama bin Laden has a story. His story is one of an immoral evil empire that needs to, at any cost, by any means, be destroyed, humbled, and brought to its knees. That's his story. And he's created a worldview that he's got others to buy into, that he is their Messiah that will lead them to a place of prosperity in favor with the author that they serve, if they will just take out the immoral evil that is represented by the United States. And so he doesn't care about who must suffer or what Machiavellian means he must embrace in order to achieve what he thinks is the right end to the story that he wants. And so he'll let innocence suffer. There is a reason that our country will never war like that, with terror, having no concern for those that suffer in the context of our advancing in the defense of others. Part of it is found in the formation of our country. See, our country, like it or not, was founded on the story that we're going to focus on for the next 9 weeks. Now, I did not say we are a Christian nation, nor did I say that every man that wrote our Constitution and Declaration of Independence was a follower of Jesus Christ. We know by fact that they are not. But you cannot deny that our nation was basically established on the principles of the story that we're going to speak about here in the days and the weeks ahead. And there's a reason that we have a certain view of how others are to be treated. There's a reason that our Declaration of Independence begins that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Because our story as a country and our belief as a country and our moorings as a country are not based on Hinduistic or Buddhistic or Islamic or atheistic ideas. Now, what has happened in our country is that this age of enlightenment, as it is called, has made some serious ground. Now, I'll tell you, God cannot self-destruct, if you'll follow me for a second, because He is good, and good will never implode. And as much as we live in context of who He is and His goodness, we will never self-implode as a nation. You can go back and look at the history of nations and find out that they consistently self-implode when they leave the goodness of who God is and the morality that is consistent with who He is. When you step outside of that, you move towards destruction, because the only thing which can continue in perpetuity is that which is solid, rock solid, and good. Everything else is corrupt and disease, and horror will befall it. George Washington, at the end of his administration, addressed our nation. And one of the things that he said is that if we ever leave what we were founded on as a basic understanding of the story about the value of dignity of human beings, and if we ever leave the basis for our morality, if we try and divorce morality from the story, divorce morality from the basis for morality, we will not survive. What Washington called us to was a strong resilience against the coming age of reason. And what has happened in the age of reason is that men have said that you should not believe that there is a divine author. And so, as I said, though the atheists will tell you that against all modern academic scholarship in the fields of mathematics and probability and biology, that we are the culmination of an unspeakable event, meaning that they will tell you that for life to form spontaneously and for order to come out of disorder, it goes against all the laws of physics. It goes against all the laws of probability, that time as we know it has not had enough of itself in order to allow the chance happening that is what their explanation for reality to come into place. It wouldn't even exist. But nonetheless, that's their story. And they say because we are here as a result of chance in their story, that there is no anchor, there is no morality, there is no right, there is no wrong, there is no moorings. And that's their story, and they're sticking to it. And yet, they don't stick to it in the reality of the world they live in. And that is why atheists on September 11th find themselves lacking any credibility. Relativists were silenced on September 11, 2001 in this country when men said, why did this happen? And nobody stood up and said, well, what do you mean, why did this happen? You speak of it as if it is evil. This isn't evil. Who are you to call this evil? Did anybody hear anybody on any of the evening news or the plethora of talk radio make the case that we couldn't call this evil? No. The Alan Dershowitz of the world stood up and said, I don't know why I can tell you that is evil. I don't know what the basis of my authority is, but I know evil when I see it. Now, really. And if we are left to let other individuals determine what is good and what is not. We are a slave, if you will. We are mercies to the powers of the moment. And God has blessed this country for as long as He has, or allowed this country to be blessed as long as He has, partly because we live, or have lived at times, in the context of the morality that He says is good, which gives life to a society. But you give a democratic people the ability to leave a relationship with Him and create their own reality, and it will self-implode. See also 2004 and coming. But this is not about America today. It's about you and it's about me. And it's about what we're going to do with the story that we find ourselves living in. One of the things that these men did, Brent Curtis and John Eldridge, in this book, A Sacred Romance, that I want to borrow from right now, is they did a great job of sharing some different stories that people will write into their life if they take the enlightened idea that there is no author. And typically what happens is people say there is no author, but they still need a story to place it in. But the problem is that eventually they'll lose the story as well and create their own. Tragedy, they wrote, still brings us to tears, and heroism still lifts our hearts, but there is no context for any of it. So what are we left to do but create our own storyline to bring some meaning to our experiences? Our heart, they write, is meant to live in a larger story. Having lost that, we do the best we can by developing our own smaller dramas. Look at the things people get caught up in, they write. Sports, politics, soap operas, rock bands. Desperate for something larger to give our lives transcendence, we try to lose ourselves in the smallest kinds of stories. Some of us choose, watch this, why does life always go wrong for me story? The plot of life for them is a tragedy. We are playing the role of victim of cruel circumstances. Our pain is our identity. This is an immensely popular storyline because it relieves us of having to take any real responsibility for our lives. Victims demand to be understood, but don't you dare require anything of them. Is that your story? That you're just a victim? And all you do is suffer pain and need to be understood, and so you live without any requirement on your own life to redeem that which has befallen you? How about this? Others write the story of being a survivor. They're a fighter. They live in a life where the plot is a siege. The world is a dangerous and unpredictable place, so I hunker down, they say, and survive. Take little risks, doing what they can to protect themselves, even if it means cutting themselves off from others and from their own dreams so they can protect the reality as they know it. Others, they say, write a story that preserves the romance that God has created us for in some way, but they pervert it and limit it specifically to romantic love. The idea that somewhere out there is that special someone who will sweep them off their feet, take their breath away, with whom they would be in one idyllic adventure with, and one unending sexual ecstasy. It's the theme of popular music. It's the false transcendence of our day, they write. Women are especially, it says, attracted to this storyline. Witness the success of Danielle Steele and her imitators. But they write, the divorce rate alone ought to be proof enough that this story fails you. That doesn't mean that human love, in the context of living with the author, does not bring us a greater piece of the story that ultimately will be satisfied in Him. It means left to itself, pursued out of relationship with Him, it will always leave you wanting. Two more. They say that the false transcendent story for men is the story of sports. Now watch this. It's the story of life as a big game, where men pursue their longings for adventure through their own recreational activities, where they lose themselves vicariously in their favorite players and teams or in their children's sports. Business fits also into this life as a big game story. Sure, things are unpredictable, but some people seem to win, and I'm determined to be one of them. I'll stay on top, travel light, and move fast. We identify with a sports team or a company because we are allowed to belong to something bigger than our small worlds. Our heroes are the few winners, of course, while the losers are quickly pushed out of camera's view. How many of you guys are living in that story? That life is all about looks and business success and worldly acclaim and money and a bigger house and being a winner so that your story makes life worth living. And you know how empty you are. And then there's the religious man or religious woman story. It's a popular story that we try to reduce the wildness of life by constructing a system of promises and rewards, a contract that will obligate God to grant us exemption from pain. It doesn't matter what the particular group bargain is, which is called doctrinal adherence, moral living, or some sort of spiritual experience. The desire is the same thing in our story, to tame God in order to tame life. Never mind those deep yearnings of the soul. Never mind the nagging awareness that God is not cooperating. If the system isn't working, it's because we're not doing it right. There's always something to work on with the promise of abundant life just around the corner. Plenty of churches and leaders are ready to show you how to cut a deal with God if you'll just cut a deal with them. This is the tournament of narratives. And we are searching, they write, for a desperately for a larger story in which to live and find our role. All of these smaller stories offer a taste of meaning, adventure, or connectedness, but none of them offer the real thing. They aren't large enough. And so our loss of confidence in a larger story is the reason we demand immediate gratification. Listen to this genius line. We need a sense of being alive for now, because now is all we have. And so without a past that was planned for us and a future that waits for us, we are trapped in the present. And there's not enough room for our souls in the present. And I would add, and therefore we are sick of heart. Folks, if you're sick of heart, I want to tell you something. I'm not here to tell you today that you are bad, that God is good, that He went through a great sacrifice for you in order that you might be restored to Him so that you can be good until you wait to go to heaven with Him. I want you to know that there is a God that is so wild in His love, so courageous in His unfolding of sovereign power, that you can't resist Him when you know Him. And the problem that most of us have, and the reason that we are not compelling others to know the God who is the author of our faith and the perfecter of this story, is because we have taken it out of its context. And we have accepted a propositional idea that not only doesn't answer our questions, it leaves us wanting more. And we are very vulnerable to the tournament of narratives. But when you know this God, and you know who He is and His radical love for you and His pursuit of you behind the beast outfit and His redemption of you as a slave to the wicked witch of winter, you welcome Him into your world and you embrace His heart of gold and you experience life even in the midst of difficult pages with hope and a transcendence that makes the world say to you, "Tell me your story." When you see someone love in such a way that it speaks to your soul that divine is real, you walk up to them and you say, "Would you give an account? Would you make a defense for the hope that is within you?" And that's exactly what the Scripture says that people who don't know the story of God should do to us when they see us living in confidence with the author. You live in a story. And I'm going to make a case that the real story, the only nonfiction story, the only one that can satisfy what you're looking for, is the story of Scripture. And I'm going to unpack it for you in the next 9 weeks. But what I want to convince you of today is that the author is good. And that the reason that in every story that you love, there is redemption and romance and rescue and union and love, is because you were made in His image. When you think about the story of the Scripture, where are you going to begin? Most folks turn to where? The book of beginnings, the book of Genesis. And I'm going to tell you that if you start reading in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, you've already missed the context that our story, which is the history of the world as we know it, is written into. If you were going to make this into a movie, into a play, Genesis 1:1 is Act 3. Act 1 is introducing you to the one that will guide you through the rest of the play. And you don't turn to the in the beginning that is in the Bible in Genesis 1:1. You turn to John chapter 1, verse 1, where it also starts in the same way. John 1, verse 1. You ready? Once upon a time in eternity. In the beginning. In the beginning of everything that ever was, God was. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was God. Excuse me. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. We find out in John chapter 1, verse 14, that we beheld His glory. When? When the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, we saw His glory. Glory is the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. But that is when we leap thousands of years ahead, to where this Word that was with God, that was God from the very beginning, enters into our story and we see Him for a moment. And we find out that he is the visible image of the invisible God. And everything about God that we want to know, we can see in Jesus. You want to know what God is like? Look at who Jesus is. But you need to understand something, that from the very beginning of time, at the beginning of the story, God was already existent in a perfect harmony, in a fullness of melody that brought richness of life in a fellowship of hearts. God existed in the person of the Father, which you know is that long, strong baseline that carries us through. But the Father didn't exist alone, because with the Father was the Word. And the Word brought melody and life. It's what we experience and what carries us through. It's the easiest thing for us to grasp. It's the melody, the fullness and the body of what God was. But the Word wasn't alone. There was the Spirit that brought the completion and the harmony. The Bible tells us that God has always existed in three persons who are one in essence and yet are distinct in their roles, as distinct as the sound of a cello, a viola, and a violin. And to take God in any one of these, to hear only the bass line, to hear only the melody, to hear only the harmony, is to miss God as He's revealed Himself. You will never know your author until you know this about your author. He has eternally existed with community, with companionship, with mutual commission, commitment and submission. Love has eternally existed in the person of God. And you were made in His image. And so you cannot resist knowing Him and not resist the love that comes only from this author. When you think about God, you need to understand that the Father is not the Son. The Son is not the Spirit. The Spirit is not the Father. But the Father is God. The Son is God. And the Spirit is God. And together, they make the music that is our story. When you wonder why you respond to romance and to love, you need to remember that you were made in the image of a God that has eternally existed in a love relationship, who cannot be defined outside of relationship. The Father is not the Father without the Son. The Son is not cherished apart from being the Father. The Spirit is not sent and does not carry forth exalting the Father and the Son without those that are there to exalt. There is a mutual admiration society with mutual submission and glorification. Listen to what happens amidst the Trinity. The author that we serve. The Father, at the baptism of the Son, said, "Look at my Son. I am well pleased with Him." Later at the Transfiguration, He says, "This is my Son. Listen to Him." The Father doesn't say, "Listen to me." He says, "Listen to the Son." The Son says, "Not my will, but Your will be done." The Son says, "The Father is greater than I at this moment, at this scope in history, as the Word became flesh. It's not about what I want. But I humble myself before Him, and being found in the appearance of a man and being made in the likeness of a man, I will become obedient to the Father, even to the point of death." The Son is compelled by the Spirit into the wilderness and submits to the Spirit. And yet the Son tells you that the Spirit will come and reveal to you truth about Him. The Son says, "It's better that I go so that the Spirit can come, the helper, the completer. And He will lead you into all truth." Jesus says, "I am the truth." Jesus says, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. To know me is to know the Father. To hear me is to hear the Father." The Father says, "The Son is the one whose name is above all names." And when you understand the love that exists as the Scripture reveals God, you understand that submission, love, community, completion are not the highest ideals of men. They are the eternal attributes of the God who exists. And our God alone can make the sweet music which resonates with our soul, that you hear behind me. Now, what so many of us do is we trade this author, this composer of reality, in for something else. And you guys have heard the Epson ads on commercials, on TV, on the radio, where it talks about the fact that there are different printers that will actually get the ink to the page, that you can still read the story. But if you make this your printer, if you don't go with the real design, then you're going to miss out on the fullness that God intends for you, or if you will, that the printers intend for you to get. And so, as we bring down that sound, in another analogy, you would say, to have your story written by any author less than God sounds like this. Tinny, different, hollow. But the case that we're going to make over the weeks and months ahead is when you understand that God is the composer of the story that He calls you into, it sounds like this. There's a richness to that music that you go, that is right. And the tinniness and emptiness of life is only gone when you find out who your author is that caused you to live in a relationship with Him. Now, when you see God at work, when you see something in life that speaks of divine love, it makes you stop and take notice. There's a famous story about an event that happened at the Special Olympics a number of years ago, that there was 9 physically and mentally challenged athletes that were competing. And the gun went off and 9 of them broke from the line. But after a few short steps, one of them stumbled and tripped and fell. And one of the young gals with Down syndrome that was running heard the cry and the stumble behind her. And she turned around. And when she stopped, others saw her stop. And she went back to her fallen comrade. And she stopped and picked him up. And the others, because this was the Special Olympics, and they didn't know that the story of game is life and winning is what makes you great, they all turned back. And they all came to that fallen soul. And they kissed his wounds. And they picked him up. And then holding hands, they walked the remaining 90 yards and crossed the line in unison. And it says that everybody that was there to this day remembers that event and speaks to it as a pivotal moment in their life. It says that there was a standing ovation, that all 9 of them were given gold medals. And nobody could resist the story of love and community and care and what real victory and meaning in life looks like when they saw it. When you see something that divine, it resonates with something deep within your soul and go, that is who I need in my life. That is the God that I want that will stop for me when I fall in the race to attain greatness and will kiss me in my wounds and will embrace me and walk with me together. And together we will experience the glory that is the relationship that we live in. This God who has revealed Himself as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit has made different statements about Himself. And He says this in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 31. The Lord your God, me, I am compassionate, He would say. I will not fail you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant with your fathers which I swore to them. In Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 17, He says, I am a God of forgiveness, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness. Psalm 86 says, but you, O Lord, are a God, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness and truth. Psalm 103, the Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness. Psalm 145, the Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and great in loving kindness. When Israel was at a great moment of crisis, when horror was falling on them, when the pages were difficult to read, there was a moment that God showed up. And He said, I want you to know who you're trusting in. And in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 7, He says, the grass will wither and the flower will fade, but the word of the Lord will endure forever. And you can bank on it. And when the people cried out, well, then who is our God? Who should we trust in? God said, I'm going to introduce you to God, and I want you as a nation to declare to others who they should trust in. Look at verse 9 of Isaiah 40. It picks up by saying, get yourself up on a high mountain, O Zion, bearer of good news. Those that know the author, lift up your voice mightily, O Jerusalem, bearer of good news. Lift it up. Do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. So now we're going to meet God, this author. And what do you think God's going to do when He reveals Himself? He says, I am the Lord God, and I will come with might, with my arm ruling for me. Behold, my reward, I personalize it, is with me, and my recompense will come before me. I am a stud. That's what He says. And I back down from no one. Courage is not only mine, victory is mine. And you trust in the author who will win. But He's more than just a conquering general. He's one that comes to serve and to love. Remember what this follows. Here is your God. Here is your author. He is in control. And He loves you. Like a shepherd, I will tend to my flock. In my arm, I will gather you as lambs and carry you with me in my bosom. I will gently lead you to the place of nourishment, refreshment, and life. This is your God. This is the author of the life that you live in, whether you want to believe it or not. And if your life is tinny and wanting and empty, I will tell you it's because your God is too small. Your story is fiction. And God takes the book and invites you into it to trust in Him as the author. Now, next week, we're going to deal with a problem. And the problem is, if God is sovereign and in control, if He is God and He is there and He is good, then why does evil befall me? Where are you? Why are there so many difficult pages to read? Explain to me, please. For today, you need to know this. You can kick against the goads as much as you want. God has an answer for evil. He tells you that one day He will satisfy your want. And until then, He is still sovereignly in control, firmly entrenched in the heavens, doing as He pleases in the context of His glory, which He refuses to keep for Himself because He is a God of love. And love, by nature and definition, is never selfish, never self-serving, always other-centered. And so He cannot contain it in Himself. Because He is loving, the Trinity must burst out that love and share it with others. God did not create you because He needed to experience love. God created you because in His goodness, He required of Himself the necessity that He would share it with those that in His kindness He wanted His glory to be a part of their world. God is not seeking glory. God is revealing His glory to you, and He's inviting you to come participate in it, in all His wildness, greatness, drama, and love. And His goodness and kindness and compassion cause you to change your story if it's not in humility and surrender before His. Father, I pray for my friends that are here today, whose lives are being lived in the context of story, who want to understand why they're here, why there is evil, why you aren't doing something about it, why stories of love, as we saw in Seattle, resonate so deeply with us, why we resonate so much with stories of redemption and courage and rescue, why we can persevere now while the story moves towards a climax, knowing that our author is good. Even if we are written out of the pages of history shorter than when we want to be, we know that You are good and will make even that right. But God, we need to know You. And while we are alive on the ink that is our history, I pray we live life fully with great confidence and, Lord, in relationship with You. And we declare the good news to others that they don't need to live in fear, because there's a kind God who has told us to fear not. And I pray that His kindness would jerk us out of our rebellion of self-authorship, and that we would repent of putting the pen to our own life and learn to live in wild, abandoned, reckless relationship with You. May Your kindness lead us there.